It started out one night when I was alone here, and I'm practically never alone. My wife goes out, it's maybe for 10 minutes or half an hour to go to the store or something like that, you know, and back shortly, and there's always somebody around. But that night, September 11th, 1976, the time was 8 p.m. Saturday, on that evening, they decided to go to a movie, a drive-in movie, just something they wanted to see, and wondered if I would mind if they went to the movie. I said, oh, go ahead, I've got plenty of things to do. So, a wife, my son, and my son's wife went to the movie. And I was alone for an extended period of time, for the first time virtually ever, you might say. Nothing never happens. Well, it did happen just a short while ago. They went to a movie. And I don't go to movies. I sit there and I watch a picture, and I could be better using my gray matter, absorbing something of factual interest that I can utilize. I read tremendously, but never fiction. Absolutely never. It has to be factual, and it has to be something I can make use of. Never read about an MIB, never heard of an MIB. I've surely heard of UFOs, flying saucers and whatnot, but who hasn't? But whenever as I mentioned before, whenever I run across an article in a paper, magazine, book or whatever, the article is about UFOs, I characteristically skip the article because it's neither proven nor disproven, at least as of that time it wasn't to me, at any rate. So I would just skip the thing, let it go, because there's other factual stuff that I wanted, you know, that is known, used to add to my knowledge. And while they were out, the phone rang, and I answered, man's voice on the other end. And he said, he identified himself, if I remember correctly, as the New Jersey UFO Research Organization. That's what he told me he was, the vice president of it. Yeah. And I understand from Dr. Schwartz that this has been checked out and there is no such organization. It's purely fictitious. And he wanted to know if he could come here and talk to me about the Stevens case. And, well, I thought the man had credentials, perhaps, and so forth. And strange, I didn't ask his name. This is not characteristic of me. Remember, I asked you, double-checked on your name after you told me that later on. And I always do this because I like to know who I am talking to and what it's all about. I didn't ask for your credentials tonight because I know Betty. Otherwise, I would have. And he asked me if I was alone. And I said, yes, I am. And I agreed to talk to him. And it's not characteristic of me to do this unless a person, either I know them or they can identify them or they're with somebody that I do know. Okay. And I do have to be somewhat defensive because I do have drugs on the premises. You know. So I have to be a little bit careful and not to be overguarded, not to be foolish about it. I don't want to be paranoid, of course. And so the man hung up, said he would be right up here. So I walked from the phone in the hallway to this door right here, turned on the light. And the man was already coming up the steps. Now, if he was even as close as across the street telephoning or next door telephoning, he could have not possibly have gotten here as soon as I did to turn on the light for him. So I didn't ask who he was. I just opened the door and said, come in, you know what I mean? That's not characteristic of me either. I don't know what was the matter with me that night to be so lax and so open. So the man came in, and he asked if he could sit down. I said, yes. So he sat right there where Betty is sitting now, and I sat where you're sitting. And the man's attire struck me as a little odd. He wore a black suit, neatly tailored black suit, black shoes, black socks. It looked like a very dark blue shirt. It wasn't quite black. He had a black tie. He wore a derby. And you don't see derbies very often these days. This is a black derby. And it was just as round and polished as could be. And I thought to myself, without saying so, I said, this guy looks just like an undertaker. I had that appearance about him. And when he sat down, he removed his derby. And I thought, this character's as bald as an egg. And indeed he was. He didn't even have eyebrows or eyelashes. Smooth skin, looked like plastic, like a soft plastic skin. Like a doll, perhaps, you know, except that it was a dead white color. Just plain white. His nose was very small and short. It came down to about the average distance above the upper lip. But the bridge was low, very low. Just a little pug nose. And his ears were small, set low, and set rather far back. His features didn't have the normal balance. His lips were ruby red, brilliant red, which I thought was odd. And I wondered about it. And we talked. He wanted to know about the Stevens case. And I asked him what he wanted to know about it. And he questioned me a little bit. And everything I said to him, he said, yes. He says, that's the way I understand it. His eyes weren't remarkable. They weren't round. They weren't slit-like. Unremarkable, except for the lack of the distinguishing eyebrows and the eyelashes. That's the only thing. From where I was sitting, I really couldn't tell the color of his eyes. But they did. They certainly appeared to have an iris and pupil. They weren't just blank white, you know. But I wasn't observant enough to see the color, except that they were sort of darkish. They might have been brown or a dark blue or green. I don't know. It was a dark color to the eye. And, of course, I couldn't see the size of the pupil either for that same reason, because one would blend into the other at that distance, and the lights weren't on very bright anyhow. And I had these other lights on, still very fluorescent lights. And I noticed when he sat down, well, when he was standing in the first place, he had the appearance of a clothing store dummy. His suit looked like it had just been put on and never had been worn, you know, or even walked in for that matter. And not a wrinkle, absolutely flawless, nice sharp crease in the pants. And the odd thing was that when he sat down, the crease in his pants did not disappear. The pant legs did not seem to be filled out. They bent at the knee. But there was no drawing or pulling as you would normally occur when you sit down. So the crease stood right up over the knee. And that really struck me, that the super perfection of this man's attire, even after he sat down, you know, it was still absolutely perfect. Just to that razor crease. As I talked along, he merely confirmed that everything was as he understood it. I wondered really why he was even asking me these things, because there was no contradiction, no questioning, nothing. It was just everything as he understood it. The only talking he did to amount to anything was to say as much as, well, what happened next? And that was about it. He didn't lead me on or ask me a lot of questions or anything like that. He just wanted to hear the story. And he kept the story going by asking things like that. And then what? Or what happened next? You know? Or what did he say after that? You know, little things like this, just to keep the thing flowing, you know? But not in a sense directed questioning, but more or less to keep the conversation going. So other than that, he didn't speak. That's all, except to say that he understood it. He spoke in an expressionless, monotone, scanning speech. This was the only thing. And this was the way I recognized his voice as being the one on the telephone. It was characteristic. He spoke flawless English, absolutely textbook English. No accent. He constructed no phrases and no sentences, just a sequence of words evenly spaced. You see? Scanning speech, they call this. And his voice was completely neuter and passive. No inflection, no intonation, nothing, you know? Just like you'd get it from a machine that could talk. That's about it. While he was asking me to continue, I noticed that he wore gloves. It looked like gray suede gloves. And he idly brushed his lips with the back of the glove. And when he put his hand down, the back of his glove was bright red, and the red on his mouth was smeared. And I said to myself, this guy's some kind of a queer. He's wearing lipstick. And I could see that his mouth was a perfectly straight slit. Apparently did not have what we call lips. So the lipstick was put on as a decoy. But it was most poorly. The lips did not turn up, turn down. They did not smile. They did not form an oval. They just simply flat. Like a dummy. Charlie McCarthy. Exactly. Just like that. I didn't see any teeth, by the way. And his head seemed to blend into his collar. He had a receding chin. He did not move his head at any time. He didn't turn his head. He did not nod. He was perfectly immobile. Of course, he didn't move his head, as I said, in any way at all, except when his entire body moved. This guy's a pretty good coin magician. He told me that I had two coins in my left pocket. He didn't ask me. He just said, as a matter of fact, you have two coins in your left pocket. This I happen to know to be a fact because I had just paid the paper boy and I had a dime and a penny in my pocket. So the man was right without me checking. I knew this. Anything else was in my wallet and was in bills. So I admitted that I did have two coins. And he told me to take one of the coins out of my pocket and hold it in my hand. I put my hand in my pocket and I took the larger of the two coins, which was the penny. And it was a bright new copper penny. So I held it up like that in my fingers. And he says, no, flat in the palm of your hand. And so I held my hand out like that and put the penny in the palm of my hand. My hand extended. And I looked at him. I looked at the coin. He says, don't look at me. Watch the coin. So I did. And it started to develop a silvery color instead of a coppery color. And then the silver became bluish. Then I had trouble focusing on it. I could focus on my hand perfectly well. That was my reference point to this. But the coin was getting quite fuzzy, quite out of focus, quite blurred. And then the coin just simply was gone. Not abruptly, it just slowly dematerialized. It just wasn't there anymore. I didn't feel anything. I didn't smell anything. I didn't hear anything. It was completely without event of any kind. The coin just simply changed. That's all. Changed in color, first of all, and appeared to be silver, and then became bluish, and then got all out of focus. It didn't glow. It was not a glowing thing. It was just a sort of a fuzzy ball in the end. It was no longer a flat, fuzzy disc. It was just round all over. I was just too fascinated with what was going on to think of looking at him. And I think under ordinary circumstances, I would have scrutinized him while this was happening, you know, by glancing or whatnot, but I was spellbound at this phenomena. And I knew this was happening in my hand because I could feel the weight of the penny going away. So I didn't even look at the man. I don't know what he was doing. If he was doing anything, I think I might have heard it. Except for what I saw happen. You know, I don't think he did any hocus pocus or moved his hands, and he didn't say any magic words or anything like that. It just occurred in complete silence. And he asked me that if I knew Bonnie Hill and Betty Hill. I said, well, I said, I've heard of them. I know of them. I don't know anything about them, though, really. I said, except I think that Bonnie Hill is dead. And he says, that's right. And he says, do you know what he died from? I said, well, I'm not sure, but I understand he died suddenly, so I think he might have died of a heart attack. I later found out that this was not quite accurate. And he says, that is not exactly the case. The reason he died was because he knew too much. How he died, I said heart attack. He said no, because he did not have a heart, just as you no longer have a coin. This is pretty convincing evidence to me that these things can be done. I saw it my own eyes. It's not a second-hand thing that I might have read someplace. He said he died because he had no heart. See, no. Wasn't autopsy performed?
No. Uh-huh. A spinal tap was performed when Bonnie was in a coma.
Yeah, but no autopsy.
No. But he died in the hospital. And
that might have been very revealing. He died under suspicious circumstances, you know. Well, all right, that'd be another matter. This could have been very interesting. He then told me, or rather I should say he stated, that I had tape recordings on the Stevens case, on the hypnosis, and on the details and so forth. And I was a little bit frightened after this coin thing happened. I was getting a little uneasy. Then he said I had tape recordings. You know, he didn't ask me. He didn't tell me. He just said it. You know what I mean? So it wasn't an order or anything else. And then he told me that when I admitted it was true, and also correspondence relating to the case, I admitted this was true, he ordered me to destroy the tapes and any other correspondence, and indeed anything I had in writing or otherwise, that had anything to do with UFOs. Even not, if not connected with this case at all. Anything. Get rid of it. Not the least bit indignant, not the least bit angry. He just said, do it. That's all. And he said that he would know when I had done so. And also, he did leave a threat. If I didn't do so, I would suffer the same fate as Bonnie Hill. He did not say he would come back or anything, but he did say that he would know when I had done that, gotten rid of the tapes. He didn't say as he had ordered put in an inhuman machine way, if you see what I mean. You know, if I can get this across. Then, as he spoke his last words, I noticed his speech was slowing down. Slowing down markedly, but not slowing down as a phonograph would, with a change in pitch. His words became slower and farther spaced, but retained the same tonality. You see? He slowly got to his feet, unsteadily. And he said very slowly, My energy is running low. Must go now. Goodbye. Just like that. No intonation, no phrasing, no implied punctuation or anything. Just like that. He walked a few steps to the door. I never got his name. Boy, I don't know. I must have been absent of my senses that night. I opened the door for him, and he clung tightly to the railing. And as he went down the steps, 1 foot at a time, 1 foot down, the other foot forward, to the same step. He didn't go from step to step. He took one step at a time with both feet on the step. He was very unsteady. And I was afraid that he might fall. And I watched him. He very slowly walked to the corner of the building here, not the way he had come in, but towards that way. I watched him walk, and he went to the corner of the building, and he held on to the corner of the building for a moment, and then he disappeared around the corner. Well, as he was going out, I saw a bright light coming in the driveway. It seemed simultaneously as he disappeared around the corner, I first became aware of the light, you know, and I thought he was going to a car. I thought, well, must be automobile headlights, car parked in the driveway. But it was different. The light was brighter, and it was bluish white. It was not like incandescent light. And it was a cold light, and it was brilliant. Now, I did notice one thing. I didn't see a shadow as he walked, as I supposed he was walking towards the light. And I suppose he would cast a shadow. And I reasonably and firmly believe that if he was in the beam, he would have cast a shadow, because he was a material substance. No question about that. So I rushed to the kitchen window, which is right along the driveway, because I wanted to see if he was getting in a car, or if he would fall or anything. And I didn't see anything. I didn't see any light. I didn't see any man. So I rushed out to the front porch. And that's the only way to get out of the driveway, because there's a large hedge on one side and the house on the other side. You can't get through the hedge very easily. So I waited there for a very few minutes. Nothing came out of the driveway, so I went off the porch, went to the entrance of the driveway, looked up the driveway. Nothing there. Nothing whatever. I didn't see anything. Cars went by, but I didn't see any car going out. And I didn't see anything in the driveway. So I wondered if maybe it had gone through. You can drive through this driveway and around back of the other house and come out another driveway. It's sort of a horseshoe-shaped driveway that serves three houses. So I didn't know what to make of it. I didn't think to look up. It just didn't occur to me. If I had looked up, I might have seen something, or I might not have. I don't know. You know, I was very much shaken. I was really shaken, badly. Left all the lights on. I'm not a little boy who's afraid of the dark, but I want to know who is around me. So I have the outside lights on. I have the kitchen light on. The interview only took a matter of minutes. I can't tell how many, because I didn't seem to have much of a sense of time, but maybe 20 minutes. There was no odor or from the man or anything. And, oh yes, when he came to the house, the dog, which is half collie and half German shepherd, he whined and he ran into the front room, into a closet, and hid. The cat was unmoved. The cat just lay there, not bothered. But the dog was terrified and hid. And I had quite a time getting that dog out of the closet afterwards. Quite a time. He just didn't want to come. He was scared. He was whining. He had urinated in there. I had to drag him out of the closet. He wouldn't have come out. And I'm afraid if he was outside, he would have never come back. And the dog is not a scaredy cat, really. It's a darn good watchdog, I can tell you. I've never seen him scared at all of anything. So there you are. Just doesn't know fear. And if anybody makes a movement to me or anything, he's right there. So, I did something irrational. I took my gun out. I have 38 special revolver for self-defense. I've never had to use it, but I have had a few scares with junkies coming into the office and coming to the house door, and I decided I should have something here, and after having to call the police a number of times, the chief of police advised me to get a gun, and I was unwilling to do so. I had never had a gun in my life, never handled a gun, except when I was a kid I had a BB gun, but I don't like guns. But he advised me so strongly to get a personal weapon that I followed his advice and got the kind that he recommended, and he gave me a permit to carry a concealed weapon, the whole thing, you know? As he says to me, I know you're not going to shoot anybody unless you really have to. He says, but I'm afraid, he says, that even if you have to, you won't. He says, so you're safe enough to have a permit. I guess he regards me as a fairly stable person. And I sat at the kitchen table, terrified, with the gun. And then I got up, took the gun with me, and I had the tapes in the organ bench, in the music compartment of the organ bench. And I also had a UFO magazine. I had detailed the Stevens case, and I had numerous bits of correspondence on it from Shirley Birchwald, you know. I ruined the whole thing. I demagnetized the tapes. And then I destroyed them physically. I really wanted to get rid of them. Absolutely. And I burnt all the literature in the fire. All correspondence. I got rid of every damn thing I could. My two sons and wife returned from the drive-in movie. Yeah, both sons came. And came about 1.5 hours later. And I told them of the experience. And my oldest boy, who's in there now, he says, let's look in the driveway. And he got a flashlight. And he wants to see if there are any car tracks. And we went out. We found in the very middle of the driveway a series of marks that looked like a small caterpillar tractor tread. Not indented in the tar, but there was some sand stuff that had blown on the driveway. And the marks were in the sand. The marks were about 4 inches wide and continued for only about 1.5 feet. That's all. The driveway was not clean. There had been a storm, and there had been a lot of sand blowing around and everything. And that's the big thing about living near a beach show. And if anything had moved out, if this whatever had moved out of the driveway, it would have left a pretty nearly continuous track, pretty continuous evidence, or it would have shown it had gone the other way, one or the other. But it didn't. It was just that. Now, no automobile could possibly have made them because the driveway is too narrow for a car to get far enough so its wheels could be in the middle of the driveway. And also, they were too deep and distinct to have been made by a motorcycle. A rubber tire doesn't make a track that looks like that, even snow treads. You know, this looked like there was an imprint of a metal, a clean-edged metal thing. Now, the marks were gone the next day, and the driveway had not been moved, used in the meantime. The tracks were gone. And there was not any high wind or anything through the night. It was very calm. All night. And no traffic in the driveway. So, we went back into the house, and everything had been destroyed and everything. And I called Shirley Pickett and asked her to contact a National Enquirer who had a story on this and to tell them not to publish anything on the Stevens case, that I would not endorse it. I wanted this stopped right then and there. And I really hated to spoil those tapes. They weren't hurting anybody. I was terrified, but I slept well that night. A week later, I had recurrent nightmares in which I could see this creature's face getting bigger and closer. Over and over again, they stopped about a week, and they have not recurred. But since then, I'd had an awful lot of trouble with the telephone, and I just about drove the telephone company crazy with my complaints. I had trouble with the phone going dead, not being able to call out. Patients would complain to me that they couldn't reach me. There wasn't my answering the phone anymore. And time and time again, they would get a voice telling them that the number they had dialed was no longer in service. Well, that's a standard tape that the telephone company does use, you know. And I assure them the phone was in service, never has been out of service, never will be out of service as I'm alive. And I says, I had to tell these people that any time you have trouble trying to reach me, call the operator and have the operator get the call through. Just tell them it's a medical matter and get the call through. And they have been successful, except in several instances the operator could not get through either and could not explain why she could not get through. And one case was quite important. The patient had to get through to me, so she rerouted the call. And I've had calls cut off, and people have gotten quite upset with me because I hung up on them, you know. And I've had an awful time assuring these people I don't hang up on anybody. Even if it's an insulting call, I wait in silence till they hang up first. I never cut anybody off, because that could be construed legally as abandonment in medical cases. You see what I mean? I've got to be careful, very careful, not to get hooked by anything like that. So I never hang up on anybody. And a lot of time there have been all kinds of clicks, and followed by background sounds indicating that there's an open line someplace. You see what I mean? I could hear things going on, yeah. And they weren't going on here, and they weren't going on at the other end of the line. And in both cases, the other party had a private line, and of course, I always have a private line. But never was anything said. I never heard any voices. I just heard sounds, you know, of maybe something being moved, or paper rustling, or whatever, you know, just, of course, I'm not naming particular sounds, you know what I mean? Just for example, just background noises, no voices ever. And then there'd be a click, sometimes after a while, we'd be silent, no interference. And I complained to the telephone company, I don't know how many times, and they told me there's no way that anybody could get into my line except at the central office. And at the times indicated, they checked back, there was nobody working on the switchboards at that particular time. They said a repairman might have flipped into a line in the process of checking, but they found out that no one had been checking at that particular time. And finally, what they did was to put in a private relay, not a rack, but stack, relay stack, for my phone, because I was having so much trouble, and the telephone company had documented it. They had meant come out here and listen. And also, they had connected, I think they call it a demand-on tape recorder. So any time the phone was used, the recorder would start. Or any time the bell rang, for instance, say this would start. And then it would stop when the phone was hung up. And it was a cassette that you couldn't take out. The whole thing was locked. This teal box, you know. And they put that on for about a month. And they came back and they said, there's no question about it. Somebody's tampering. So they put in a separate relay stack for my phone, locked in a separate steel box. So nobody can touch it. The big question, there's no telephone that's as close to my back door that he could be there when I turn the light off. I don't have enough knowledge to base a conclusion on. The only thing I know is from what he said, and that is about the coin. He referred to the coin being no longer on this plane. Not planet, not place, plane. He says the coin is no longer in this plane. Scientists have theorized for years on alternate dimensions. As to what I think this man was, or where I think he may have come from his statement about a different plane for the coin, I must go along with what many others think, that there are other dimensions, and the man, I think, undoubtedly came from another dimension. I don't think he's an invader or anything like that. And I think they're just nosing around. I don't think they intend to hurt anybody. And certainly, as far as the known record goes, they have not hurt anybody so far. Except, question in my mind, the one thing, Bonnie Hill. That has bothered me no end.
When we come home, he was all shaken up and he had his gun on the table. And I had never seen him like that, never. He was all white and all shaken up, and then he started to tell us the story. And he didn't want to have anything to do with UFOs. He destroyed everything he had on it because he was told to, or else he would join Barney. That's what he told him. You know, he didn't know what would happen to him. We'll always remember coming home and seeing the gun on the table. He was that scared.